Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another drizzly day in Joburg. And we nevertheless go ahead with Sarah Gone Rogue with me, Sarah Gone, to look at matters political and political adjacent, as they would say. And together with my sound engineer, Craig Guthrie, we'll take you through and see if we can't at least trigger a little interest, if not a little sunshine, in the process. Well, the news has just sort of dealt with one of the issues I was going to raise, which was the alleged deviation of 4 billion rands worth of salary adjustments for Johannesburg City Council workers, who have threatened to disrupt the G20 events over this weekend by blocking exits, entrances, and all manner of access to the proceedings, because they have been suffering from a wage discrepancy in that they are paid less than employees in other metros. I'm not quite sure how that came about, but apparently the assessment was made as long ago as 2016 that there was the shortfall, that Johannesburg workers were being paid at a grade 8 level, whatever that means, instead of a grade 10. So the city has denied it. The opposition has said it's nonsense. Money has been set aside and taken, in fact, possibly from water and JRA infrastructure upgrades. But be that as it may, it's obviously a perfect opportunity to try and put some pressure on the government to increase these amounts. Of course, what one doesn't know is whether there are too many people earning at too high a level over metros in general. Why the discrepancy appears to have arisen, and I can't imagine that Johannesburg would be the only problem metro in this regard, but it's been about affordability and sustainability, and we know that Johannesburg's finances have been somewhat depleted for a number of years. So unless the other metros are just much better run and much better handling their finances, that might explain it. But certainly I can't see the financial situation getting any better. And as the DA says, you know, money does have to be ring-fenced for what it is budgeted to do and not easily moved across. So they, one way or the other, they may or may not have averted a disruption, but apparently there's another disruption, this time threatened by the ANC Women's League, who say, "Don't provoke us," as it tells the ANC-led GNU, "to declare gender-based violence a state of disaster by Friday or face disruptions." So it's turned up the pressure, warning that the ANC-led GNU must declare gender-based violence and femicide a state of disaster by Friday, or "Die Poppes sal dans." The things will get hot and testy, colloquially saying. Now, Secretary General warned that the ANC Women's League would not hesitate to bring the country to a standstill if the government of national unity fails to act, and saying that there's no bigger women's formation in South Africa, the country can be brought to a standstill, and the sooner the decision is made, the better. She says, "We advise the state to be proactive rather than provoke us and wait for the last minute, because we will be left with no choice but to join hands with those who believe strongly that for them to get the attention they've been crying for, they need to disrupt the economy. We certainly have a crisis with gender-based violence, but whether the factors that go into it are as strongly societal as they can be for the state to deal with." And the question I would ask is, what is the ANC Women's League doing, either on its own or with others, to try and minimize the situation? You're never going to resolve it.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Now, the draft business licensing bill has been gazetted for public comment until the 28th of November. Now, the bill aims to introduce a national registry of every business operating in the country. The Department of Trade and Industry says that the bill is intended to modernize outdated legislation and create a uniform system where all businesses register with and obtain licenses from their local municipality. And it's meant to replace the current Business Act of 1991. Now, under the proposed law, every business would need a license valid for 5 years. Municipalities would then have 30 days to grant or reject an application with an option of extending by 14 days in certain cases. The problem is that generally commentators, economists, business groups, employers associations, etc., warn that the new business licensing laws are unworkable and potentially damaging for jobs and investment in South Africa. Now, it's quite something when you unpack it. You'd basically have a situation where inspectors, and presumably you would need to increase the number of people employed by vast amounts in order to police this, in order to manage it, would have broad powers to demand proof of a license at any time, issue fines, or confiscate goods if laws are being violated. Now, the government has argued that the bill will introduce a simple process with a set of norms and standards which are intended to support better governments. But the reaction against it has been quite intense. Dr. Brian Benfield, who's a retired professor at Wits and a board member of the Free Market Foundation, has actually called the bill dangerous and warned that its real impact would be devastating. He says that beneath its euphemistic promises lies a blueprint for bureaucratic domination, one that will make starting, running, and even maintaining a business in South Africa more difficult, more uncertain, and more perilous than ever. He says that the powers that the bill confer are sweeping, vague, and discretionary, and that's very worrying in a society like ours, where they say that it's as he says, you're likely to end up with arbitrary enforcement, rent-seeking, corruption, and an uncertainty that chokes investment and suppresses job creation. And this seems to go against the very idea of what is needed to create jobs in this society. And it certainly seems to go against the idea of the of government's intention to seek job creation through business creation, through small businesses and small or medium-sized businesses, as almost 90% of the basis on which these problems, particularly of unemployment, will be overcome. There are added things that they mention, and particularly mentioned by the National Employers Association of South Africa, which represents about 7,000 businesses, who have also condemned the proposal. They note the elements of the bill that amounts to discrimination by introducing preference systems that could influence who qualifies for a license. So they submit that essentially what this is doing is putting forward BEE, is reinforcing rather BEE in disguise, and warned that they preclude any group of society from being eligible for obtaining a business license based on demographic or national background. Now, I mean, that is absolutely antithetical to all the arguments that have been developed and put forward on the need for growth and growth to generate business development, which in turn would generate new jobs. But this is the approach they've taken, and it seems to be very much part of the sort of doubling down element of the ANC in putting in place those or exacerbating those measures which are seen as being excessive and unworkable, and particularly issues like BEE and preferential procurement. It just doesn't make sense. Well, it does make sense, but it doesn't make business sense. So there's the risk that the very approach, according to Nyasa, is that the approach is both exclusionary and it defeats the very purpose and principles of encouraging a free market. But again, as I say, this seems to be where the ANC is at. Business Unity South Africa has taken a slightly different view in that they acknowledge that there is merit to the goal of improving oversight and supporting business growth. But it's also warned that it's adding to an already heavy compliance load for small businesses. And looking at and having experience with registering a business and making sure that you keep, you know, in good favor with the South African New Revenue Service, already in terms of considerably sophisticated legislation, this seems as very likely to be adhered in the breach more than anything else. I think it also fails to recognize that with regard to this society, there has to be an acceptance that with all the formal business and the ability of businesses, particularly big businesses, and very frustratingly for small business, to comply with all the requirements for starting, registering, and running a business and being tax compliant, there's always been an element of the society where businesses operated on an informal basis. And to expect what is a large informal sector to comply with additional regulation that just may largely just create suspicion that it's intended to monitor and act perniciously, perniciously possibly with corruption behind it, seeking bribes to declare businesses properly registered. It just doesn't make sense in a South African context. But it goes further. I mean, SACHA-Lecha, which is well known for challenging legislation pertaining to issues that negatively affect the conducting of businesses in this country, says that it would support any policy that genuinely aims at reducing licensing burdens. But SACHA-Lecha argues that the bill does the opposite, and it believes that legislation of this nature will undermine economic growth through regulatory overreach, complex, multi-layered bureaucratic hurdles, etc. And the inclusion of the socio-political objectives in the system means that you end up with the very likely that they will be considered unconstitutional, and it will be challenged for that reason.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Now, since the last SARA Gone Rogue, we've had the Minister of Finance, Enoch Godongwana, produce the medium-term budget policy statement last week. And it seems to have been fairly warmly received from a range of quarters in a way that budget-related pronouncements and prognostications have not been for very, very many years, and particularly given the major budget scenario that occurred this year, with it being delayed due to disputes over the increase on VAT, particularly, it seems like it was a complete change in tone and consideration. So I thought to unpack this, I would ask Chris Hutting, Executive Director of the Centre for Risk Analysis, to explain to us, Chris, first of all, what is the medium-term budget policy statement? What does it do? And why was it so warmly received?
Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for yet another opportunity to talk about financial and fiscal matters. You know how much I enjoy looking at spreadsheets and unpacking all these things. As our erstwhile colleague at the Institute, Ian Cruikshanks, you know, tried to reiterate a lot. It comes down to what this means for people's lives, you know, why are these numbers important? So just in a nutshell, the medium-term budget is a sort of projection towards the main budget for the following year. It sets various priorities and that the main budget then should hopefully ordinarily fall in line with. So various projections, estimates by National Treasury, for their credibility, it helps when the main budget then matches what they forecast or expected or announced in the mini budget. So it adds to their credibility if they get it broadly in line with their own calculations. And it also gives you a signal in terms of government's broader sort of monetary and fiscal policy. What are their priorities? Do they want to spend more, spend less? What sectors are they prioritizing? What are they doing for public sector workers? Are they going to continue to give support to certain industries? What's going to happen with taxes? All that sort of stuff. So it's a, yeah, I think in sort of good practice, it is a useful check-in, as it were, into the country's finances.
Mm. I mean, I gather that for a start, there was a bigger tax recovery this year than anticipated. Not so much on private income tax, but certainly on VAT. What is behind the increase in revenue? Because revenue is obviously always an attractive proposal to put before the public.
Yeah, absolutely, and I can say immediately, the increased revenue is not on the back of high economic growth and growth of the middle class. So, we have mentioned this week in our weekly client risk alert that we send to our clients every Monday morning, that there is a risk that our politicians and bureaucrats think, oh, there's more revenue coming in, debt is expected to peak next year, so therefore everything's fine. What are we worried about? Like the economy, yes, we're only still growing around 1%, but we've got tariffs from the US and got tension around the G20, but actually things aren't that bad. So why do we need to, you know, reform in any substantial sense? But just on the revenue point specifically, I think a lot of it comes down to increased capacity on the part of SARS. We haven't necessarily seen that with things like the Madlanga Commission, which does ask the question, you know, if there is more investing in people, in sort of programming, in AI to assist SARS to collect more revenue, why isn't that being targeted at the people, you know, that it should be with corrupt and wasteful expenditure? Mm-hmm. But that's another matter for another day. So it's mostly on the part of SARS functioning better than it has been for a few years now. Maybe that'll carry through. It's also been helped a little bit by the two-pot retirement system reform, where a lot of households took some of that just to spend. So pure spending would have led to some higher tax receipts and tax revenue collection. Okay. But I don't think it's sustainable, again, in the context of that our economy isn't growing as much as it should be.
Right. And did commodity prices affect the revenue intake?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a very important point to highlight. In the last 12 months, given the sort of the volatility coming from the US and questions about the Federal Reserve and the dollar and all that sort of thing, generally then your investors and your markets go to things like commodities, and South Africa has benefited from that because we do still export a lot just in terms of critical minerals, coal, those kinds of things. Again, we're not benefiting as much as we should have done. So if our ports, our railways were functioning like they should, if our mining sector wasn't, you know, driven down as much as it has been in the last 15 years, we would have benefited even more from a tax take revenue point of view. But yes, I think you're right to mention that. And I link it back to what I said earlier, the risk that this breeds some complacency. You know, South Africa perennially rides these tailwinds from some commodity cycles turning upward. You can't plan your sort of fiscal stability on that alone, because there will be a downturn again at some point. So yeah, it's important for South Africa to get those policy structural reforms right, so that it isn't just a case of, well, let's wait for the next commodity cycle that helps our tax take.
So, again, we're looking at growth. What about expenditure? I mean, you talked about the sort of high expenditure items in the past of bailing out sort of failing or struggling SOEs, not to mention an always large public sector wage bill. And certainly at the national level, the sort of proportion of high sort of management to the sort of the middle management worker level is disproportionate. It's very, very high. And so we've always seen this extremely large public sector wage bill. How much is that always, that tended to be part of the expense, how much percentage-wise is that of tend to be of our expenditure, and what they're talking about going forward?
Yeah, so the debt situation has been, you know, more and more concerning for the last few years. That's as you rightly point out, number one, because you're spending more, but you're not spending on productive things. You're just spending on salaries and other sort of vanity projects. I'm surprised there wasn't a line item for the G20. G20 summit alone. There has been for the G20 presidency, but not for the summit alone, because that's going to cost quite a bit. Those of us in Johannesburg will have seen the orange pots and some of the G20 signs. I wonder who got that particular contract and how much that thing cost. But anyway, so just on the public servants, public service side, in this medium-term budget, more than two-thirds of total expenditure goes to civil servant wages, social transfers or grants,
right,
and debt service costs. So almost 60% of your total budget goes to those items. So the public sector wage bill, I think, continues to be a massive line item. There is talk of paring it down and pushing back on above-inflation wage requests. But again, you know, that'll come down to whether there's the political will, right, or not. It's one thing to say, you know, we pencil this in the budget, but it's another thing to then actually hold the line when it comes to those negotiations. Just on SOEs specifically, there was, I'm just trying to double check on the specific number, but there is increased support again for Transnet. So Eskom is looking a bit more stable, but Transnet, given its own debt situation, I think government is trying to say, look, we're trying to concession private private investors in rail. Let's continue to give Transnet some support for the time being. Just to reinforce that point, Transnet was offered new support to the tune of 145.8 billion rand, which pushes government's contingent liabilities to over 700 billion rand. So it's a substantial amount still.
Right. And things like the cut in interest rates and the strengthening of the rand, has that had a positive effect on reducing expenditure?
Yeah, that helps a lot on the debt, and especially your interest on your debt. So generally when interest rates come down, your debt repayment costs are lower, so that helps a lot. The confirmation by Treasury that South Africa will now aim for this 3% fixed inflation target should help in the long term, because it also helps to manage sort of wage negotiations expectations, right, on the private and public sector side. But as the Reserve Bank Governor Lesetja Kanyoho, to his credit, has reiterated throughout his term, the Reserve Bank can do all it can on putting in lower interest rates, but if other government departments don't reform, if they continue to push up prices that they set, so electricity, water tariffs, municipal rates, those things continue to feed inflation and constrain economic growth. So I think that's very important to keep in mind. I think it's right to set a lower target for South Africa in this context of a sort of global context as an emerging market, but how you get there is the other question.
Right. Well, certainly lowering the inflation target also makes it more difficult, but not impossible, for the ANC's allies in COSATU to argue for higher wages due to a higher inflation rate. And although they seem to somehow always end up with more than the inflation rate, quite unlike in the private sector. Any generally any sense that there's any dent being made to the effect that corruption has on the cost to this economy? I mean, as you referred to the Madlanga Commission, and there's the ad hoc committee in Parliament looking into the alleged criminality at high levels in the police. But is there any real sense that any of this is making a difference from a financial point of view? Are we just hearing more about it?
Not in terms of the hard numbers, not yet. I think hopefully this can be sort of calculated at some point, but not for the time being. I think partly because, again, that, you know, brings home how much damage has been done, so you can avoid some accountability in that sense. But not in terms of the budgets themselves, not at this time.
Right. How much difference does it make? Because they talked about new offers of early retirement for 55 to 59-year-olds with no retirement penalty, and then 2 weeks for 20 years of service and 1 week thereafter, and similar situation for people in the retirement band to up to from 60 to 63. My concern about this is, this in itself would require a greater expenditure to actually achieve this. And the other thing is whether you're not run the risk of losing institutional memory that you desperately need in a public service that one often feels is just not competent enough to get the work done. Do these measures actually end up saving money?
Yeah, I think you highlight it's that that trade-off point. And to mention the Reserve Bank governor again, he last week at an address, he mentioned that in policy there are only trade-offs. There's never one, you know, one is that one thing is perfect with no cost. So, yeah, in our context of declining civil service, of departments that don't function like they should, yeah, I think there's a very important point around retaining the capacity and the skills, but also how you target then the spending on things like salaries and wages, that you do it for the right kind of people. This links to things like cadre deployment and patronage networks, the, you know, real important things for the ANC specifically, how it's built so much influence over the years. If you then start to ask these kinds of searching questions about, you know, is the money going to the right people? Are they receiving the support they need? You want to retain the skills, the capacity, the knowledge, the years of muscle memory. You know, it should be really targeted, and you see the effect if that isn't done. If you favor just political connectedness over merit and skill and sort of capacity. So there is a question here. Maybe the issue will become more focused as the sort of debt situation continues. I know in the mini budget, Treasury does forecast the debt to GDP ratio to peak next year, but they are National Treasury and the Reserve Bank, well, more National Treasury, they are famous for overestimating our growth rates and underestimating our debt growth. So that remains to be seen. But for the time being, the debt picture is going to be tight, which means your spending needs to be as effective as possible. Mm-hmm. As Gabriel Krauser from the Institute of Race Relations has pointed out, South Africa hasn't had austerity. Our government expenditure has been growing for years, but the quality of government has been declining. So there again, the question is, yes, you want to spend on wages and have a public service, but are you really doing that in a value for money kind of way?
And comment on the sort of on the primary budget surplus, which, as I understand, is where income it's achieved with income minus expenses, excluding interest payments, that the revenues actually exceeded our expenses. Talk a little bit around that, explain it to our audience.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So your primary budget surplus is you achieve that when your revenue exceeds your non-interest expenditure. So that talks to our growing income, as it were. If this was your sort of personal, your household balance sheet, your salary, for example, exceeding your expenditure for a particular week or a particular month. And that is quite remarkable in and of itself, and credit should be given. If indeed this happens, that this primary budget surplus improves to 2.5% of GDP, it would be an improvement from 0.5% of GDP in 2023-24.
Okay.
So that's over a longer period of time. It's not just 1 year or two. It does show you that there is a bit more fiscal tightening and fiscal responsibility, not as much as, you know, those of us who want smaller government would want, but it's on the right kind of track at least. Right. So it is important to mention that. If it does improve to that 2.5%, that's equivalent to around 224 billion rand. So it's nothing to be sort of, you know, sneezed at. I think it is important. Let's see if they can continue to maintain that. And also just, you know, in the context of a young government of national unity that has had various wobbles, there would still be the temptation to spend on big ticket items like the National Health Insurance, Basic Income Grant, and those things might yet still in some way come about. Mm-hmm. However, it's important that we continue to not see real support for those in the mini budget or in the main budget. Mm-hmm. So resistance against some more populist spending items. And Minister Gorongwana, just on the NHI, he pointed out his concerns around the floating by the Department of Health the idea to remove medical tax credits.
Yes.
The impact that would have on the middle class. So you are seeing some pushback from within some quarters in our government against, you know, more destructive policies. And that pushback is coming broadly from National Treasury and from the Reserve Bank.
I think people were quite impressed by that because he said otherwise nothing else about NHI, and he was essentially supporting what he describes as the an attack on the middle class, as particularly the one-third of which pays most of the personal income tax. Our removal from the grey list, from being grey listed, rather.
Yeah, that's. I think that is real boon to National Treasury and people like the Deputy Minister of Finance, Ashul Sarupan, the work that they did in concert with entities like the NPA, our justice system. Whether they can follow up on this now is a different question, and if we can actually see prosecutions around, you know, sort of high level cases, because if you don't see that, then again, it's one thing to have it in the letter or the spirit of your sort of prosecution setup, but if you don't then actually enforce it or can't enforce it, then things like the Financial Action Task Force, they will then ask serious questions about, you know, are you doing what is best from a governance and a sort of oversight point of view. That does help in terms of just the appeal of our bonds, our financial sector. It is good from a narrative point of view, the fact that we did it so quickly.
And I was going to leave it there, but I just wanted to ask you quickly one question, and that is that Standard & Poor's have given us an upgrade. You just want to comment on that. Is it in response to this, to the medium-term budget statement?
Yeah, it's in response to a few things. So the medium-term budget policy statement, it's also in response to our removal from the grey list. It's also broadly a reflection of improved fiscal consolidation and our GDP growth rate hopefully lifting up from where it was. It's from a very low base, but hopefully lifting up. So this was the first time that Fitch has upgraded us, our credit rating, since 2005.
Okay.
So we could be seeing one or two signs of a turnaround, but in the data, I don't want to get on the hype train just yet. You mentioned earlier in our discussion, you know, everyone is getting bought into that this is the best budget ever. I'll give it some time to see. Let's see what we get in the main budget next year.
Chris, thanks very much for coming on and explaining all of that to us and give us a tiny little glimmer of hope for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Well, as Chris alluded to a couple of times, the problem with the government and with the indications from the medium-term budget policy statement is that we really have to grow, and there is really nothing. While there was a prudence expressed in it and sort of positive takeaway from it, there's no indication that the government is going to make the necessary policy changes to see a proper growth. In fact, as we described with the business registration legislation that's coming in, it's more of a hindrance. It's adding another hindrance to growth, because one of the issues that one always looks at to encourage business development is reducing rather than increasing the red tape that comes with it. They're looking at growth rates of moving perhaps into the 1.2% range, etc., up from 0.5, 0.4% in the last couple of years, which is almost no growth at all. It probably is, in fact, no growth. And as Chris said, the Treasury has a habit of sort of overstating and overestimating future growth, and which always has to be revised downwards. Now, you have a population that is growing at 1.1% per year, and it will take time to lift real incomes and make a job in joblessness, even if the economies were to grow at sort of, say, 1.8%. We're also struggling to attract more fixed investment, and that's investment both locally and foreign investment. And we're currently looking at registering around 15% of our gross domestic product, when in fact it should be closer to 30%. So while the Treasury is sort of doing its part and the Reserve Bank is sort of doing as much as it can, it ultimately comes down to policy and a financial policy that just tends to the dyed in wool socialist direction rather than encouraging free markets and giving South Africans the recognizing the agency to do the work. And that's still a stumbling block. And the GNU, which has been sort of given credit for the more positive medium term budget policy statement, has not yet seen a shift in that direction. In fact, as I said earlier, we're really just looking at high levels of doubling down on restrictive and limiting policies that don't encourage or even discourage the creation of businesses, and thus the need to have jobs to make those businesses effective. We've seen that the budget deficit is forecast to fall by 2.9% from 4.7% by 2029. Now, this is very positive, and it is indicative of the pushback against high public sector wage increases, et cetera, and the policies such as national health insurance. But everything looks at being, you know, so much less than we need. I mean, we really need growth rates, for example, of 5-6%, which is the sort of growth rates that have been experienced by equivalent economies elsewhere in the developing world. So, you know, something very, very dramatic has to happen. And whether the ANC is at any time up prior to the next local government elections at the end of next year or the 2029 national elections is actually going to make that policy change. There was some rand strengthening when Minister Gordon Gwana made his speech, and you know, so far generally the cost of debts are dropping, and the debt ceiling is said to be reached this year and then start to fall. So who knows? Maybe we'll see how it goes. With regard to the ratings upgrade by Standard & Poor's and Fitch, the grade went from BB- to BB, and it's generally considered that South Africa is always consistently two notches below investment grade, at least two of the three major agencies. It's again that one's considered always a slight improvement, but never improvement enough. But as I say, be it as it may, we'll have to see how these things pan out, and whether the GNU actually has a more substantive impact over time. There's definitely support for it, although I think people have become a little world weary and concerned that it's not going to result in those policy changes that need to be made. And God knows we need that increase in investment, because we need to improve infrastructure, and infrastructure is crucial to growing the economy, to making the ease of doing business for the private sector greater, and to allow the private sector to really have access to infrastructure, roads, railways, etc., that make doing business easier. And not to mention some of the appalling situations we've had with the backlog on water infrastructure in the last few years, and amounts being diverted as a result. So we're a little positive, maybe. Okay, let's watch and see.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'm not sure if you know that the DA went ahead in pushing a vote of no confidence against Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi, probably in the full knowledge that it was not going to get support. If you look at the situation that the Patriotic Alliance, the IFP, Rising Mzansi, in coalition with the ANC, and Action South Africa is in coalition in Pretoria and probably don't want any negative consequences as a result of this. as well as the fact that the EFF and MK would never have supported the DA, and BOSA has a Build One South Africa, Mumisi Maimane's outfit, has its own perhaps vendettas. Why would they have gone ahead with a no-confidence vote that they were likely to lose? Now, the no-confidence vote came about because the public protector has determined that that Pinyaza Lesufi's crime prevention wardens, who were irregularly established with no legal mandate, they go by the colloquial of name of Ama Pinyaza, and that was always a concern, is they were tasked to deal with crime-related matters without having the sort of training that police have, and I don't know if having more police in the current climate would be of any use. But it was nevertheless, the establishment of these crime prevention wardens was deemed to be irregular and illegal. It seems like the DA has done this really to be able to go into the local governor election saying these smaller parties, these parties that is theory the alternative to the ANC, did not support their vote for a premier that really should be on his way out. What was strange about the public protector report is that it instructed that I think 30,000 odd wardens go for retraining under the Gauteng Traffic Police, under the control of the Gauteng Traffic Police. Now, I assume it's for things like, pointsmen for when traffic lights are out, et cetera, et cetera, or ticketing. I don't know if they would fall within their framework, and that this training should happen over a period of 18 to 36 months. My concern is that, and awful as it may be for the wardens, is that if the whole system has been declared illegal, that's it. It is not for the public protector to find alternative ways to keep them trained or retrained in order to carry on earning salaries for jobs that they are not able to do for the now because they're illegal, or in the future for which they require at least 1.5 years training. That struck me as really, very, really odd. And when undertakings go in, retrenchments have to occur. And awful as this is no different. And it was a bad idea in the first place. But anyway, it is our lot in life to deal with the bad ideas of government. And in this regard, I will be back next week to look at other things that interesting. See if anything interesting really comes out of the G20 summit, and whether any of the disruptions that have been threatened actually occur. Being over the weekend, of course, it should help their traffic problems. But we'll have a look and see if there's anything worthwhile, or anything worthwhile in politics in general. Over the next week, we'll speak next Tuesday, and look forward to seeing you then.